been running in the same circles and kicking up the same dirt, maybe even since before we were old enough to drink. I mean, it's been a while, so.
Well,
Yeah,
from
it's
Kansas City, what is that, like 12? Are you a good drum tech? Okay. All right. Fair enough. Fair
Well,
enough. Fair enough.
that was
All right.
kind of an
Yeah.
op I did an Oprah tour. Yeah, it was
So
a
there's, okay, let's review now. Buses, trucks, and catering. Yeah.
There were trucks and catering.
That wasn't a tour then. I'm sorry. That's
Okay.
just a series of one-offs, Kevin.
And Mike Inez is just a sweetheart of a guy. You know.
I
But
had him
we
on. He said he didn't like you. Hey, this is Party Like a Rockstar podcast, and I'm your host, Joel. Today's episode is brought to you by Misha's Kind Foods. They're an LA-based small business making the world's finest non-dairy cheese on the market today. They're lactose-free, paleo, keto, kosher, Perev, and 100% vegan. If you like what you see, check out the next video. If you like this video, please subscribe and like by clicking the little round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or our other guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle is Joel Rody. If you haven't already read my book, Memoir of a Rody, it's now available through Amazon and paperback, Kindle, or as an audiobook. I hope you enjoy the show. Robert Scoville is my first guest. He's mixed over 4,000 events in the last 40 years, I'm aging you, that he's worked in the industry. Some of his acts that he's worked for are Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Matchbox 20, Jackson Browne, Rush, Def Leppard, Tesla, Alice Cooper, Toto, Air Supply, The Go-Go's, Foreigner, and Prince. He's currently on the Here and Now tour working for Kenny Chesney. Are we still doing that?
Yeah, feels
Okay.
like at least 5,000 shows by now. So, yeah, we're right in the middle. Actually, we're not in the middle of it. We're coming up toward the end. We got about 8 shows left, I think, 1 month to
Okay.
go.
Been a good run?
It's been an incredible run, unbelievable. I mean, what
Wait.
a what an incredible luxury cruise, man. That is a Eight
it is.
shows, 1 month? Yeah, Yeah,
you heard me right.
yeah,
I
tough there. That's really
know,
hard.
I
That's really
know.
not a tour either.
It is a tour, Kevin. It is
No.
absolutely a tour. We have buses, trucks, and catering, so that makes it a tour. Sorry.
My second guest is Kevin Cassidy. I'm now the production manager and stage manager. Stage manager. He's worked for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Alice in Chains, Ozzy Osbourne, Soundgarden, Bette Midler, Iron Maiden, Van Halen, Hank Williams Jr., Neil Diamond, Fleetwood Mac, Paul Simon, Jethro Tull, Cheap Trick, Metallica, and John Mayer. He recently got off the road with Bon Jovi, and he's currently on the road with Def Leppard and Motley Crue. So welcome, fellas.
Thank you. Cool to be here.
Good
Good
to be here.
to be
I mean,
here.
present company
Yeah.
excluded, you know what I'm saying? So
I feel honored. I feel honored. So first question here is, with all your spare time, this stuff here, I was reading, Robert, the Alcatraz Swim Challenge, the Great Wall Marathon, world's toughest mile. You're the most unlazy roadie. Are you still doing this crap? I mean, this is kind of nutty
I
stuff.
wait to be lazy until I'm on the road. I mean, I'm sure Kevin can verify this. You know, that's yeah.
I have pictures that will verify
Is that where you guys met? Was on this Great Wall Marathon?
that.
Yeah. No,
No,
I was
it
in a
is
shark
not.
suit in Alcatraz out in the bay following him.
Is this really like code names for tours or?
Right. Well, it's funny, you're reading off our resumes and really one of the first times we worked together. That was the first time we actually worked together, right, Kevin? Was it on Shooting Star? I mean,
I
we
want
obviously we both grew
yeah,
up in Kansas City, so we knew each other
I think
working
we
all this
actually
stuff.
did some local music festivals where
That sounds right.
sound which we call it what was it sound not sound image who was it that was
Superior
local?
sound.
Superior Sound, yeah,
Yeah.
Superior Sound. But I think they were the audio vendor, and the company I was working for, Sect, was the lighting vendor. But yeah, seriously, we actually worked together on a band called Shooting Star, which is a regional act that should have
Okay.
been bigger than what they were.
Way bigger,
Are
yeah.
you guys both still in Kansas City? No.
I am. I moved back in 2000. I took over. I left the Obie company in 2000 and took over a production management job at Starlight Theater here in Kansas City.
Sure, I know it, yeah. Oh, cool.
Yeah, I think we've kind of been running in the same circles and kicking up the same dirt, maybe even since before we were old enough to drink. I mean, it's been a while, so.
Well, yeah, from Kansas City, what is that, like 12?
Well, it depends. I think you can get, well, I used to work at a bar in Kansas City that served 3.2 beer. You know, it was a place called Players Rock Showcase. I'm sure Kevin came into there every now and then.
Wow.
Oh, man. I can't believe I just thought of that. Oh, my gosh. There's so many dark memories coming.
So were you mixing, like, you were mixing at the bar? Is that where you started in the beginning?
Oh, mixing drinks. No. Yes. I was, I was the bartender. Drinks.
He was the drum tech for Shooting Star, the band that we started with when I first started knowing.
And monitor engineer. Don't leave out that important qualification there.
No.
Are you a good drum tech? Okay. All right. Fair enough.
That was kind of awkward silence. Let me call Steve Thomas right now and see what he says.
Well, you can call Kenny Arnoff too, because I was his drum tech for a while too.
Yeah.
I'm gonna say some of these odder ones. Oprah Winfrey. What did you do for Oprah, Kevin?
Kevin. What did you do for?
Yeah. What did you do for Oprah?
Lighting. Yeah, it's a lighting crew chief. It was a huge lighting crew. There's two of us. We had a front and back truss, and it was an awesome tour.
Wait a minute, you did an Oprah tour?
I did an Oprah tour, yeah. It was
so there's okay, let's review now. Buses, yeah. Okay. Trucks, and catering. Yeah?
There were trucks and catering.
That wasn't a tour then, I'm sorry. Okay. That's just a series of one-offs, Kevin.
It was, there's a whole bunch of one-offs. But it was awesome. We loaded in, traveled on a Thursday. It was like doing country music. Traveled on Thursday, loaded in on Friday. And then the show was Saturday morning at 8 a.m. And it was an all-day sort of thing. Every arena was sold out to the gunnels. And it was over about 4:30, 5 o'clock, depending upon how long Oprah talked every Saturday. And we're back in the hotel by 7 o'clock Saturday night and flew home on Sunday.
Oh, tough gig. So what, she's just doing her interviews and talking to people and stuff?
Yeah, it was sponsored by Weight Watchers, and she, I guess, has a financial stake in Weight Watchers as well. Yeah. It was a kind of a self-enrichment weekend sort of thing. But it was good. It was, you know, really, really cool. They had a bunch of inspirational speakers, and they always had a celebrity out, ranging anywhere from Michelle Obama to, The Rock. You know, so it's somebody different every weekend. And
Weight Watchers, this is for Batty, who just cares about catering. It's a grody buddy. That's all he really talks about. Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you guys know Batty, but did they give you Weight Watchers or did you?
It was actually the catering was structured around a Weight Watchers meal.
I was
menu.
Just going to ask it. I had to ask.
And,
yes.
And it was really good. I got to say, I mean, I did actually.
And did you drink or do you drink? I don't know.
I don't.
Pretty much
only when I'm around Robert, and it forces me to consume.
Yeah, it's alcohol. Necessary. It's necessary.
Yeah, for it's the only way that I can really get by. Yeah.
Again, Kansas City thing, right? Well, that's an interesting tour. I like this. And then I do like Jethro Tull a lot. I actually was hoping to get Ian on here, but I guess he did an interview. I think it was on one of my buddies' podcasts, believe it or not. And he talked about how, like, nobody really needs a roadie. He could do his own guitar or whatever.
Was it on Left Sets?
It was on my buddy Darren Paltrowitz. I don't know if he said it on that one or not, but
he stopped said that doing on, interviews. It wasn't on Left Sets as well. It was a killer podcast. I loved it.
Wow. I don't know. I think he's great, but it would have been fun to talk to that guy. I would have asked him some random shit, but... Yeah. But was it a good tour?
I was a big Jethro Tull fan when I was a kid. Boy,
I was too. I mean, I saw him at
fantastic
Arrowhead Stadium. They had the big Tullavision.
Right.
It was just a big video. It wasn't even a video wall. It was a video screen upstage, you know, back then with projectors. But the tour itself, we did the Crest of the Nave tour, and it was awesome. It was a really good time. Band, everybody was really pleasant to get along with, and just in general, a good time. The funny thing is that album, I think it was MTV, one of the new categories, I think in 19, that was about 87, 88, somewhere in there. One of the new categories for their award show was Best Heavy Metal record.
Yeah, and they won over Metallica, right?
Yeah, and they beat Metallica and Anthrax, and
he's never lived it down either.
Yeah,
I had Bobby Schneider on early on. He came on with Bob Dates, and and Schneider was saying they all dressed up. They were sure they were going to win, and then Metallica lost.
Yeah,
I feel like that was it to Jethro Tull in there. Everybody's like,
well, to me, it's kind of the biggest tribute to Jethro Tull because it means they couldn't find a category for him.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just kind of, I don't want to say empathy or sympathy vote, but it was one of those things where it's like, wow, Tull deserves an award. Let's stick him somewhere. And okay, let's go heavy metal. Let's give him that one.
You know? I'm still on a regular basis, thick as a brick. Regularly have to listen to it. Yeah. Still love everything about it. It's great. Yeah. And only did two.
The first time I saw Tull was in St. Louis when I was living there. This was probably 74, maybe 75. And I remember them advertising that it was the first time there was ever going to be flown sound in Kiel Auditorium in St. Louis. I just, for some reason, that stuck in my head. I just always remember the advertisements about that on KC Radio. And it was, you know, it was a big mono system that was flown up right above the center of the stage. It was like, unbelievable sound quality at Jethro Tull for flown sound.
So were you like a sound guy when you were a kid? Like before touring, were you like trying to get your speakers sounding good, Robert? Or
Yeah.
So why'd you do the drum tech thing? It was just a gig because you were a kid for a few minutes, or?
Well, no, I mean, I wanted to be a musician for the longest time, for sure. And I was
drums, or
yeah, drums. And then kind of got introduced to the production side of it at a really pretty young age, and really just kind of said, no, that's what I want to do right there.
He really couldn't hack it as a sound guy when he first started, so he had to find an alternative.
And are you the one who told him?
Became a backline guy.
You know, it actually is a little more than that. You know, at that, I mean, I've said this before. At that point in the game, you know, in the late 70s for sure, like if, you know, as an audio guy, if you could get good drum sounds, like whether it was in the studio or live, you were going to work. I mean, you were going to find work if you could do that. And that was kind of my forte. That's where I was pretty
strong. What was your first nationwide tour?
Shooting Star, for sure.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we were out opening for all kinds of people. I mean, it was a great way to make connections and move on from there. That's for sure.
Did you guys do your second tour together too, or that's where you start splitting up and doing other stuff?
Robert, you took off and like went and did a John Cougar or something.
Yeah, I went to Mellencamp, right? After Shooting Star. I did the Pink Houses thing with Mellencamp as Aronoff's drum roadie. And then went to work for a company called Electrotech, which was formerly TFA Electrosound out of Canoga Park. And that's when I really got all the sound work. They didn't need drum roadies there. They needed audio people there.
In L.A.?
In Los Angeles, yes.
And yet they still hired you.
Yes. Yes. Wow. Despite your recommendations, yes.
What is virtual sound check and Melita track archiving workflows and... multi-smart guy stuff going on, right?
Yeah, those are all things that he's made up and just
reshaping the
good
role of concert audio that I have here.
For some reason, I feel like I'm going to be asked to validate all of this right now. Is it
only if Kevin cares? I don't.
I'm waiting.
Yeah. Well, virtual sound check is a way of pretty accurately sound checking in an arena or a club. It doesn't matter where you do it. Without the band present. So you basically can operate the mixing console with multi-track audio that it was recorded from a previous night and get the room to sound the way you want, get the PA to sound the way you want.
What does this mean for roadie bands? Are you trying to cut the fun out of the job?
See, you jump right to roadie bands. You know, I can tell you this, there were a whole lot of video directors that were really pissed off at me about it because it killed all their great footage of bands sound checking, you know, because bands didn't need to come in and sound check anymore. I remember the guy that does all the Petty's filming, he was like, I can't get any time with them on stage because you're doing the damn virtual sound check thing, you know. So
did they do sound check a lot, Petty's team?
What's that?
Petty did sound check all the time, or?
No, we did sound checks, like regular sound checks up until 2005 when this concept of virtual sound check got released as an actual feature on a digital console. And Petty got exposed to it. And because I feel weird saying it, but I kind of invented it. So I spent about 10 years working on the process and refining it. And then once the thing went fully digital with the Avid, or the at that time DigiDesign consoles, it was part of a whole package. And I never showed it to him in those previous years. We just did it, and we would do virtual sound check and a regular sound check.
Wow. And so then gives Kevin more time to sleep in the afternoons.
Well, they need focus time. They need more time to focus in and really rehearse their cues. So they need this time really desperately. So
yeah.
But once we got to 2005, we never did another live sound check, maybe one or two over time for the next 12 years, you know.
I think part of that too was as the band stopped using buses and started flying, they stopped coming in. And I think part of them doing sound checks was driven by the fact that they were bored in the afternoon and they were sitting, you know, at the venue in a bus. So
yeah,
in the early days, they were always around kind of lurking and you know, they might as well get up and play.
Virtual sound check kind of eliminated that.
In all honesty, I think it's brilliant, Robert. And I hate to say that. I hate to give you
a compliment. I know it pains you.
No, accolades.
It really pains you. But I don't understand why it wasn't done sooner. It just seems so logical.
Because you didn't have digital recording. You didn't have big track count digital recording available to those positions. Hmm. Right. Not until 1994, really. Right when I started with Wildflowers is when the modular digital multi-track came online. And you could have, I mean, if I wanted to do 48 tracks of digital recording pre-1994, I mean, it was $250,000. To do it. Whoa. I mean it was expensive. And then once we got
more
to
than
the
Kevin NBA, gets per tour,
well per night at least,
per night.
I think you might want to check his lifetime aggregate. It's probably maybe just approaching 240. I'm gonna guess maybe 235.
Yeah,
but you know, I'm kind of with Kevin there. You know, kind of one of those things that I think no one saw coming with virtual sound check is that, especially for a band, you know, that it was long in the tooth as Petty was over that time. I mean, they had been together 20 years by the time I joined them. Almost anyway. I think it extended their career. I really do. I have no qualms saying that, because they didn't have this grind of coming to the gig every day and hanging out in some dank dressing room and, you know, having to listen to opening acts while they wait to go on stage. That was not in place anymore. You know, they could just hang out at the hotel, relax, no rush to get over to the gig. I mean, there were nights where they would, I mean, but we were doing line check and changeover and they weren't in the building yet. You know, the bus would pull up, they'd walk off and go up on the stage. So it made for really good performances, really kind of on fire performances. Honestly, it did. And you know, obviously I'm a proponent of it, but I think it's a really cool thing. We're using it out on Chesney now. Same sort of thing, man. People are just kind of going, gosh, this is easy out here when we don't have to have sound checks every day, you know.
I had Corey on here from Living Color. Stephen Huss brought him on, and if you guys know Stephen. But Corey said that he used his sound check day like every day, and they go as long as they can because they actually write their music during sound check.
Peace. Yeah, totally. If that's what you want to do with it.
Yeah. Did you guys have that with any tours? I'd never heard that before.
Well, let me think.
I mean, as a stage
here,
manager, that'd be a pain in the ass. On stage all day.
God.
Well, there's some truth in that. Yeah, if they're going to hang out for hour upon hour upon hour, yeah, that would get pretty daunting on a tour, no doubt about it, in my mind.
Rough. Cut into Kevin's afternoon massage and bubble bath time.
Yeah, Mr. Bubbles.
Well, I mean, we're kind of doing something similar like that on Chesney right now. And, you know, it's funny how it kind of turns around. You know, the band was really excited about, oh, you're the virtual sound check guy. This is great. Well, we want to give that a try, all this stuff. After 2 months of it, they were like, oh, we kind of need something to do during the day. How about we come over and record a sound check record? You know, let's do that. So, you know, over about 3-4 shows now, they've come over and are recording all these cover tunes that they might end up releasing on a record. So, you know, grass is always greener on the other side, I guess.
Yeah. How about you? How'd you climb the ladder, Kevin? Why'd you go into stage manager and then PM?
I think it's kind of a logical move. You know, I'm doing lighting on Def Leppard Motley. That's always been my forte, but recently I've been doing all the Van Gogh stuff as a production manager. Van Gogh and Monet, and doing more stage management stuff. As soon as I finish Motley Crue,
prefer
Def Leppard,
Van Gogh's early period or late period?
his blue period?
His current period, for sure.
Blue period is Picasso.
Oh, sorry. Well, that's in Vancouver. As soon as I finish this, I'm going to go do 3 weeks with Journey as stage manager as well.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of selfish, but it dumps me in Honolulu, and I've got 30 days off that I'm going to stay at a buddy's condo up on Haleiwa on the North Shore for 30 nights.
So there's a good chance I'm not going to hear from you for a while. Is that what you're telling me?
During the month of October, you can probably write me off your calendar.
Oh, that's so good.
What was it like doing the Van Gogh Monet stuff? It's pretty easy, where you don't have anybody yelling at you. You take your own time to focus on stuff, and it's kind of artsy fartsy. People think you actually have talent.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
I so wish I'd have said that. I wish I'd have said.
Yeah, it's good actually. It's kind of both corporate and both rock and roll sort of thing. They brought us in and my team of guys. To make it more roadworthy and portable from city to city. So it's kind of the rock and roll side. But as far as dealing with convention centers and the type of venues that it's doing, it's more corporate. So it's kind of the best of both worlds for me. I just picture
like these Motley Crue, Def Leppard guys, just like, who's this new band? This Monet guys.
This Monet, no. Yeah.
Why are you busy, Kevin?
Yeah. Do we get a sound check? We'll do a virtual sound check.
I think it's definitely going to be virtual with Monet. That's for sure.
Yeah. What's the next one? They're doing Picasso now?
They actually do have a Picasso. It's in, I think it's still in Vancouver. But they have a Picasso, a Monet. We have a Monet that's sitting in Honolulu right now. We've also got an Avengers that's out. They're tying in a whole bunch of stuff. There's a virtual King Tut that's now out.
That's
in
neat.
Washington, D.C. So there's a whole series of spinoff stuff that's this new kind of immersive experience. When they initially did the first show, they did it in Miami. They did it as kind of a test run to see if it was going to be scalable. And it sold a bunch of tickets, and they kind of went, oh, maybe this is something that'll work.
Yeah.
So
one was Van Gogh.
Yeah. The first one was a Van Gogh in Miami. And it took off. It sold a buttload of tickets, and we've scaled it for larger venues now. And that's what we troop around. But there's four or five different productions of it that are all different production companies. And I think there's, out of the five or six that are out there rolling around, there's really
yours
only
is the worst.
Two. No, ours is one of the better.
Oh, of course.
Ours beyond Van Gogh is the one that I work with. And then there's another one called the Immersive Experience or the Immersive Van Gogh.
So they're not connected by anybody?
They're not connected, only by the museum in Amsterdam.
The main push is the museum.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So they've actually.
Why would you need them? Because it's all public domain. Van Gogh's totally public domain now. So the museum. I guess someone has to fund it. But if there's a way to make money, you might get some of these, some old school stuff, because they don't need permission from anybody.
Yeah, I think they're using some of the artwork that they have to have licenses for in some of it.
So how it used to work is 100 years, except for France, which is 107 years and it's public domain.
Yeah, I don't know how the laws all work.
Which one did I see here in Scottsdale? Do you know?
It wasn't mine. It was the Immersive Van Gogh. Okay. There's only two that are truly immersive. The other ones are more of a large format, just projection sort of thing. Yeah. But the ones that like Robert saw and the one that I do is literally it's like you're standing inside of the painting itself, and it's animated, and the room that you're in is 120 by 80 feet wide. It's a pretty large area.
But, yeah, I got to say the projection mapping and stuff that I saw was pretty impressive. That part of it was really good.
I just think of What Dreams May Come. Remember when he's
right? I love that movie.
Oh, it was great. The artwork stuff was killer.
Fantastic.
Actually worked for the guy who worked on that. He was pretty nutty. He would do shrooms and come to work. Conversation
for that movie.
Very entertaining.
Perfect.
That was fitting for the film. It was fitting for the film. They definitely got one in the top. Yeah. What else we got? Okay, so do you guys funny gigs, maybe even when you were starting, like back in the day, do you guys have any gigs that stand out as like, how the hell are we going to do load in here? Are we seriously playing here? Or who booked this one off? Got any ones that stand out that you guys love?
You want to go first? It's going to be hilarious if it's the same gig.
Is this Whitehall?
No, not Whitehall.
No, go ahead. No.
Well, I'll ask if you were there, because this is how blurry it is to me. Some of it is. Were you at the Head East Joe Cocker Shooting Star thing in Joplin, Missouri? Were you at that?
I don't think so.
Where, you know, you brought this up earlier, where we did the roadie band, the Shooting Star roadie band.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't think I was at that one.
For some reason, I was thinking you were there. I think Fool's Face actually opened that show. It was at some, it was outdoors at some big wooded area in Joplin. I remember it just being sweltering hot. I mean, just beyond hot, you know. And this was before Cocker broke with the Officer and a Gentleman thing with Jennifer Warnes, right? He was still, you know, living on Woodstock, you know. And I think the bill was, I think it was Fool's Face, Shooting Star, then Joe Cocker, then Head East, I think. I'm pretty sure that was the lineup. So Fool's Face plays, everything's cool. Shooting Star plays, everything's cool. Set change. No Joe Cocker. This goes on for a while.
He was out with his friends.
He was definitely out with his friends. Hour goes by, still no Joe Cocker. Promoter comes up, and we're just all hanging out at that point because we want to see Joe Cocker. And the promoter comes up and goes, "Dude, you got to help us out. Anybody play anything?" So of course Neil Babe was there. I don't remember who the whole lineup was in the band. Maybe was Passarelli there? He might have been there. Anyway, me on drums, Neil singing, playing bass, probably wearing leg warmers, and a couple other people in the band. And we were like, well, what songs do we know? So we did four songs, and two of them were Born to be Wild. We did Born to be Wild twice in front of the crowd because it's the only thing we could pull together. And we did it on the Joe Cocker back line, you know, so it was pretty amazing. Crowd went crazy. What's that?
He came eventually.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, that's where I'm coming with it.
Okay,
now.
Okay, all right, sorry. Yeah,
so we do our part to keep it, to extend the day. Cocker finally shows up, and he's wearing like this leather buckskin coat, you know, kind of fringy coat, t-shirt underneath, jeans, buckskin boots, you know. I mean, it's 110 degrees, just sweltering humidity.
You raided your closet, Kev.
Yeah. Oh, I so wish I'd have said that as well. And he shows up with a beer in his hand, and I mean, he doesn't look very stable. I'm just thinking, I'm like, okay, he's going to last about 5 minutes out there. This is going to get ugly, you know. Goes out there and plays for about an hour and 20 minutes and just crushed it. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely crushed it. And, you know, and we were all just kind of on the side of the stage, just kind of mesmerized by it, just thinking, okay, that's how you fucking do it right there, man.
Yeah. I mean,
holy cow, you know. I mean, it was impressive. And then Head East comes on and tries to follow that, right? And it didn't go so well, apparently. We were gone by this. Now, I didn't see this part of it, but I saw a couple of pictures of it, I think. But apparently the Head East set didn't go well. People got upset, etc. A piano, a actual grand piano, got flipped upside down and set on fire, you know, that kind of thing. So these were the early days, you know. I think that was probably maybe 81, 82, maybe.
You know. You got any ones that stand out, Kevin?
Golly. I do remember a Shooting Star show, and I don't know whether you were there or not, Robert, but it was I want to say it was the Kansas State Fair, and we showed up in the morning and Naked Zoo was doing audio. Uh-huh. And I'd brought in a lighting package, and of course it's windy in Kansas.
And there's nothing to block the wind there.
Oh,
that's
we're on
sure.
A cement slab, and they pull their consoles out and they're the first thing off the truck, and they're sitting in the middle of the stage, and the guys turn around and start dumping the rest of the truck. Big wind comes up and the consoles just right off the edge of the stage, and it's like a 7-foot drop off the side of the stage, and destroyed both their audio consoles, the monitor desk and the front of house desk.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh. Did the show go on?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
I don't think I was there for that.
Yeah. It might have been Weasel at that time.
Yeah. Best barbecue what's best barbecue in Kansas City?
Oh man.
What do you think?
What's one?
Yeah.
Gates.
Go on.
No.
I love the Gates sandwich. Or the place that's in the parking lot. There's one that's in a gas station.
Yeah, Joe's is really good. Joe's Barbecue. Good. That's actually on Anthony Bourdain's top 10 places to eat before you die list.
No way. I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
I like the Gates one where they shove all the different types of meats in the sandwich.
Yeah, they do the typical platter that usually winds up on the bus for bus food every time you're in Kansas City.
Yeah, we were just in Kansas City, and that's what we had.
Yeah, us too. We were there the week before you guys. But I'd say Smokehouse for burnt ends. Everybody's got like a little different specialty. Joe's has probably got some of the better ribs, everybody's got a little bit of something that they do best. LC's is really good. I haven't been there.
So I haven't lived there in so long, I don't even know what's there anymore.
You're in LA now?
I'm in Arizona.
Oh, okay. So I was putting together this podcast, Buddies Have Kids. My buddy's kid was in elementary school. And she said, with a lot of conviction, actually, she said, you should ask every guest when they first felt famous. So I ask each of you, when did you guys first feel famous? Now, I do throw a caveat, which is if you don't feel famous, that's okay. And I'm not saying you should or you shouldn't. I don't give a crap. But if you don't want to say famous for whatever, when was there a kernel in your career, a time that meant something to you that pushed you forward, you feel, in decisions to go the right way, or something that happened to you that was a moment? What would each of you guys pick?
I've just been hanging on to Robert's coattails the whole time. So,
I wish I'd have said that as well.
He is a mover and a shaker. Hopefully it's not after too much barbecue.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. Taking the stage in Joplin, opening for Joe Cocker, that was pretty good.
That is amazing. Yeah.
I've never felt famous, per se. I don't think that would be the right word. I've had a lot of surreal moments.
Yeah, meeting actually, Rocco Reedy, would that be one of your
moments? Oh, excuse me. No.
Oh, Rocco, man.
Rocco's funny. Bad. He's good.
He's infamous. I mean, come on.
There's been all these moments where, as a kid in high school, for instance, like talking about going to see Jethro Tull, at a concert, and then 10 years later, I'm working for the guy. I've had a lot of moments where it's been like, wow, is this really happening? And like working with Shooting Star, we did some dates with Kansas. I was a huge Kansas fan. That was probably one first albums that I bought, I think was probably Mask, back in the day. And we had a local radio station, KY102, that at the time was an all album format. So they played albums front to back, both sides of the album, and then they moved on. But we did a run with Journey in Europe a few years ago, 10 years ago. And it was Journey, Foreigner, Styx, and Kansas on the bill, which, it was like, this is like my high school. This is great. These are all bands that I'd go see. But it was cool because every night Kansas would sit down in catering, and I'd sit down with all the guys from Kansas, and we would sit and BS about the Midwest and growing up around Kansas City and Lawrence, and going to bars and different stuff. And it was one of those times where it's just this surreal moment that it's like, wow, this is bizarre. These are guys that I used to idolize almost.
And now you're like, pass the beans. Seriously, give me some beans.
Yeah.
Yeah. Give me the pepper.
Potatoes, man.
Quit rock starring and give me the cash.
Yeah. Would no you have your roadie here? Pass me the pepper?
That's cool. What do you got, Robert? Are you starstruck or you don't care?
Well, I got to, like, when you said it, okay, like three little things came to mind.
Sure.
And again, I can't attach the word famous with this. It's not really famous, but it's just kind of that moment where you kind of think, okay, man, you know, I might do okay here. I might make it in this, you know. And I think the first time for me was when I, you know, kind of came from just being this kind of, you know, techie lackey guy at Superior Sound and actually going on tour with Shooting Star. I remember that first truck ride very clearly in my brain, you know, me and Keener and Warren, you know, but we were going to gigs and you know, we had an itinerary. We were going on tour, you know, and I remember at that moment just thinking, okay, we're doing okay here for sitting in the middle of the Midwest, you know, in Nowheresville here, and we're going to go do some significant things here. This is going to be cool. So that was one moment. That was a very, like a moment of clarity for me, for sure.
Yeah.
And then the other one is this one. I've told this story before, but it's so fun to tell.
You
it.
Said I, three, I and now you're
well,
saying
there's two coming.
Okay, so. All right.
He can't count. He's
supposed
audience.
To be the smart
count
one.
One, two, one, two, one, two, one, two. Yeah.
Should I read this again? This reshaping of. Anyway, so okay.
So in 1974, 73, 74, yeah, maybe 72. I can't remember exactly. I'd have to look it up. But I went to my first, I got to go to my first rock concert, right? My first actual real rock concert. And my mom took me, right? This is at Kiel Auditorium, to see Alice Cooper. Billion Dollar Babies tour, you know, huge, huge deal. So mom takes me to see this tour. And I was a huge Alice fan at the time. I mean, I was so into what they were doing. So here's my mom sitting next to me in this seat in Kiel Auditorium in her little polyester suit, you know, and her scarf, you know, we're watching Alice Cooper, right? So now fast forward, how many years? 10, 12 years. And I'm working for Alice Cooper. I'm mixing Alice Cooper. And we go back to Kiel Auditorium. We're going to play the same auditorium where I went to see it with my mom. And
that's great.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was a moment, really. So the show is going on. And I had an A2 with me, a guy named Russell. I said, Russell, you're going to have to take the console for a minute. I said, I've got to go do something, you know. So I gave him the console and I walked up to those seats where we sat. Oh, and I sat down for a minute and watched the show. And it was just kind of this moment of,
yeah,
okay, doing okay. Doing okay right now.
About the people in the seats? Did you kick them out?
Well, I mean, you know, pass them a joint, whatever. You know, they were fine. You know, just, here, smoke
Excuse
this.
Excuse me, I have a moment in these seats.
Yeah. Don't you know who I am?
Yeah. Let me explain who I am. So
what year was the Alice Cooper one? That was in 74?
Yeah, it might have been earlier than that because it was Billion Dollar Babies Tour. I remember that.
Okay.
So it had to be... Man, it had to be 72, 73, 74, somewhere around there. I'm sure I still got the tickets up somewhere.
Oh, that's super cool.
Yeah, so that was a cool moment. Now, the other moment, and I like to brag on this one. I don't mind telling you. So,
okay, yeah.
I'm a Helen Mirren fan. I love Helen Mirren. I have a crush on this
She's
woman.
Super okay. babe when she was young. Amazing.
She's super babe hot. Now. Just don't even go there.
All right, I'll be careful here, yeah.
So we're playing Royal Albert Hall with Petty, you know. Kevin knows where we're going here.
Yeah, I know this one.
So she's at the show, right? And, you know, obviously she's not out in front of house or anything like this, but I go back to the dressing room after the show and she's there. And she's going on and on about the sound of the show. And I'm just melting. You know, I'm just a melting puddle of manhood at this point. Mike Campbell introduces her to me and we start to talk. And we have this just fantastic little conversation, you know. I mean, I'm on cloud nine, of course. I haven't been starstruck
been like,
too
you
many
know,
times.
You're pretty good at acting, too.
Yeah, I probably said something that stupid, you know. So this goes on, and we kind of go our ways, you know, carry on. And a couple of years later, we are at Music Cares with Petty. He's the honoree for Music Cares. And I didn't know it, but she was at the show. So we're backstage. Jackson Brown, I think Thurston might have been there. I think it was Jackson, Thurston, and Helen Mirren are there talking. And I come walking up. And before Jackson can say, Helen, this is Robert, you know, blah, blah, blah. She goes, oh, Robert. And like remembers me, right? So now I'm just completely useless. I can't talk. I'm just completely done. So that was a big moment for me.
What he's not sharing there, though, is he had a badge on that says, "Well, my name is Robert."
Right. If you're Helen, I'm Robert. Yes, that's what my badge would have said. Yes. So, yeah, that was a big moment for me. Like I said, I don't get Star Trek very often, but that was pretty cool.
I've got a friend right now. I was out to lunch with another friend, and they need private drivers for celebrity guys. And so one of the questions is, you can't get starstruck. You got to leave him alone. You're just a driver. I'm like, all my buddy does is he reads. He goes to the bar. I know him from the bar. He just sits in a corner and he reads. All he cares about is reading. He's a quiet dude. And so they're like, he's a shoo-in. So they asked him in the interview, is there anybody that you met, you know, where you'd be starstruck? And he's like, well, I met, what's his name? The guy who wrote Fahrenheit 451.
Kurt Vonnegut.
I met Kurt Vonnegut. He was behind me in line. And I just think when the guy who was doing the interview kind of like, yeah, it's not what I'm talking about.
That's, you know, that's not really
not,
it. Yeah.
It's not the guy that caused problems, but okay. is there any like wind up stories that you remember from any tours where they pulled some crap? As you as a stage manager, do you deal with that? Or you're like, hell no, Kevin, we ain't doing that. No.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's way below, no, Kevin.
I'm the instigator.
What are some of the okay, I'm skipping a bit. Did you do Alice in Chains when Lane Staley was alive or yes. After?
Oh, no, wow. During Lane was there, definitely.
Wow. So what was that like? Were you a big
awesome.
Fan? Because I'm a big fan. So.
You know, I wasn't a fan originally, but, you know, watching those guys on stage every night, and the same thing with Petty. Petty really wasn't on my radar a whole bunch until I started working for him. And just watching some of these guys, you know, Alice in Chains and Mary Chapin Carpenter, Petty and the Heartbreakers, all those people, I have a big respect for, because their live shows, I think, are much better than a lot of their radio stuff that comes out on albums.
And Petty, the thing is, it's song for song for song for song. None of them are songs to skip. You're totally fine.
And I think as the Heartbreakers went on in their careers, I mean, I think they were tighter as a band on this last tour that we did than they ever had been previously.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I think they just got better and better and better every single year. You know,
well, they kind of regrew into a band, didn't they? I look at Petty's, like, the width of his work there with the Heartbreakers, and there were the Heartbreakers grew through two bands. They grew with Stan Lynch, and then once Ferroni and Thurston kind of came involved, they had to kind of do this entire growth cycle as a band, and it definitely peaked on that 2017 tour. They were locked in on that tour, unlike anything I had done with them before.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was good.
Yeah. With Lane, not to jump back, I'm not trying to push off Tom Petty. I love Tom Petty.
No, that's okay.
But was he all drugged out the whole time? Was it really difficult to work with that guy, or were there good moments?
No, not at all. I mean, there were a lot of good moments. So for instance, you know, Lane, and I think this is probably the same for a lot of artists that have addiction issues. I think they probably have a better support network when they're out on the road touring, which may sound a little, you know, contradictory, but it's not. And this is, for instance, this is what happened at the beginning of Lollapalooza is in 93, it would have been that Lollapalooza, Susan sat us all down as a road crew and basically said, look, you guys need to keep an eye on Lane and the band, because if we miss a show, the way the contract's written, they were going to be responsible for any loss of revenue to the festival, which could have been pretty substantial.
Yeah.
But there were times where we would go out, you know, as a unit, as band and crew, and you know, Lane would get up and go to the bathroom or something, and then everybody's kind of realizing, wait, he hasn't come back, and so we'd have to send out a search party to find him and make sure that he was okay. But you know, there were a lot of times like that, but those guys are all great guys. I mean, and solid musicians, you know. And I'm still friends with Mikey Inez. You know, they're just good people, and Mike Inez is just a sweetheart of a guy, you know.
But I had him on. He said he didn't like you.
Do you got well, Mike's number? Can I call
I do, him? Actually. Yeah.
I just want to check in and see what he's using. You know, I would kind of parallel some things that Kevin was implying there, because I've seen it with acts that I've worked for as well. I mean, Steve Clark with Def Leppard would be a perfect example of one who, yeah. when he was on tour, when he was working, he was way better than he was when he was on his own and in isolation and other stuff with his addictions. You know,
well, maybe it's the idle hands of the devil type stuff.
I think that's absolutely a piece of it, you know. So, mm-hmm. you know, I feel comfortable saying, you know, given Def Leppard's history of making records, which would take forever, that was not Steve Clark's place.
Yeah.
He was not in that, you know, only on kind of on the periphery, you know, when he was doing parts, the rest of the time was just waiting, which was horrifying for him. You know, just, he wanted to be playing in front of people, period. End of story, you know?
Yeah. What are some of your windups, Kevin? What do you got?
Oh,
the list is long, isn't it, Kevin?
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's just pull a couple of petties out. For Robert, he would do his classes every day. So it became a chat. At the end of every class, he would do this class with all his sycophants, students. And at the end of that, they would all get a picture with Robert around the console at front of house. And I actually was able to enlist the services of his front of house person that would call me towards the end of his classes.
I see. Now the truth comes out. Yes.
Well, it didn't start off that way. But at the end of the class, he would kind of let me know, and myself and you know, Steve Winstead, the Mike's guitar tech, would generally try to pop up in the photo, and every day, so there'd wind up getting this photo published, and somewhere in the background would be myself and Steve Winstead in all these.
You know,
photos.
You'd think for as often as you were in the class, you might have learned something, but no, just there for the picture.
No, it took for the picture. Took me a long time to figure it all out. There's another.
You're probably
one.
In 90% of the pictures. I mean, I've looked through them. He's like, yep. there you ever are. Seen the movie Zelig? I mean, he's like the Zelig of the lighting crew there.
We did a petty tour, and our stage manager Larry Yeager was unable to be at the very last show. And this actually became a crew wide thing, but Larry left his work box, and it was going to be shipped after the last show.
Always
and Larry wasn't there. So I went and bought, like, I don't know, 200-300 ping pong balls, and we basically had a craft day backstage. So everybody on the tour would come along and decorate a ping pong ball, and we stuffed. I literally turned his box on its back so that we could get more stuff inside of it. But we stuffed this box with ping pong balls and packing peanuts, and then locked it up and sent it on its way. And speaking to Larry when he got the box, he was living in Illinois at the time, out in the middle of the country, and he got the box, opened it up in his driveway, and I guess there's still packing peanuts drifting across Illinois somewhere, but there was millions of packing peanuts and ping pong balls all over his driveway.
So he called, how did the last show go? Like,
oh, yeah, it was slow. Great. Yeah. I had plenty of time.
You know, we had, I don't know her name, but Tom Petty's wife when he passed. So where I lived, she's friends with some of the friends I'm with, and they did a themed New Year's party, and it was rock star night or something, you know. So I dressed up as a roadie, actually, which basically I wore stinky clothes and nobody talked to me all night. my friend dressed up as Tom Petty, and then she shows awesome. Up and I'm like, ooh.
And, maybe too soon, right?
Well, you know what, she was a trooper. She was really cool. I think she had a fun time that night, and I hope she did, because he had just passed away just really not very long before New Year's.
Yeah.
And she ended up she danced with him. She asked him for a dance, and so she danced with the fake Tom Petty, and I was like,
nice,
oh, that was a nice thing.
I'm sure she was great about it. She was
nice. She was very nice. It was a fun story.
Yeah. Dana's a sweetheart.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah, it was good. Well,
I so do wind ups, huh?
Yeah, if you got any other good ones, shoot away.
Oh gosh. Let's see. I, you know, one of the funny ones I remember doing on Def Leppard was we had a monitor guy named Phil Wilkie, nicknamed Side Phil.
Okay.
And he was always going on in catering about broccoli. hated broccoli. I hate broccoli. Why are they bringing broccoli in the catering? Get that shit out of here. So one day somebody got the bright idea to take his talkback mic, which he would use to check monitors and everything, unscrew the capsule and put a little piece of broccoli in there and put it back in there, which is all fine until you realize that after a day or so, that broccoli smells like, I mean, maybe the worst thing you've ever smelled in your life. So, putting the mic up to his mouth going, what the fuck? Where has this thing been? You know? So that became this regular routine. He'd replace the mic. Give me another mic, you know. A day later, put a little broccoli in it. It was just this ongoing thing.
How nice of you.
It was funny.
Way to kind of get him to conquer his fears.
Yeah, right. Another really funny one I remember from Matchbox 20. This was, and this got captured on film. This got immortalized in film. Was we were in Australia. And we had on the tour, we had this thing called blue stealing somebody. Yeah, you were going to blue steal somebody because they were using blue steel guitar strings on the tour, just going through boxes of them, you know, every day. So, and in everything, there was a blue steel sticker, a little square blue steel sticker. So if you got blue steeled, what would happen would be somehow someone got a hold of your suitcase, would open it up right before you go home and blue steel sticker the entire inside of your suitcase, close it up. And you wouldn't see it till you got home. And this was all fun and games. It was all fun, et cetera. But it went next level when we got to Australia. So we got to Australia. We're at an after show. And David Hasselhoff is there. Right? and you know, I mean, I'll say it here. You know, everybody was kind of good vibing David Hasselhoff. You know, hey, yeah, you know.
Was he singing or he just came out of here?
No, he just came to hang. Just came to be a cool guy. So it kind of went around, we're going to blue steal David Hasselhoff. We're going to blue steal David Hasselhoff. I was like, okay, well, what does that mean? He goes, watch. So every time he would come by, somebody put a blue steal sticker on his back. So by the end of this party, this guy's back, sleeves covered in blue steel stickers, you know.
Wasn't he kind of like, why is everyone touching me?
Who knows? I don't know. But it's on film. Like they were filming down there for the Matchbox 20, you know, anthology film, whatever. And it made the film.
So, right.
It was pretty cool. It was pretty funny. It definitely kept everybody kind of coming to the party. They're blue steel and Hasselhoff. Come on in, you know.
So did you get your sticker on there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You got it at the butt, right? You got him down.
No.
Okay.
Come on, Robert.
Just because he's tall. Just because he's a tall guy.
Are you saying I'm short? What's going on? Where are you coming with this?
Okay, interview's done. Right. I like that. See, those ones are fun. I like the differences. The some of them, that's the same stuff or whatever. But every now and then you hear ones, you're like, that's inventive. That's a good one.
I'll give you a great one.
Had some like crazy.
For my money, this goes down as one of the all-time greats. And Kevin, do you know Brian Brown? Guitar roadie? Guitar sound guy?
I don't think so.
I did guitars for everybody. This one was immortalized on film. We got this on film, so I can verify this for anybody that wants to see it. So we're out with Rick Springfield, right? Jesse's girl, right? So at one point in the show, every night, Rick is standing way downstage. We had this big thrust, and he's standing downstage, and he's going to start Jesse's girl. So all these spotlights hit him. I mean, this big array of spotlights. And Brian is to throw out this Telecaster from, you know, 20 feet, 30 feet away. Whew, Telecaster through the air. Rick grabs it. Strap on. Jesse's girl. Right? Here we go. So last night of the tour, everybody knows the pranks are on. Right? The pranks are on. So everybody, I mean, certainly all the backline guys and everybody were like, okay, wait till you see what Brown is going to do. Wait till you see what Brown is going to do. So part in the show comes, spotlights. Instead of a guitar, here comes this. It had to be a 30 or 40 pound fish right out of the tank. I mean, it was still wet, just flopping through the air. And Springfield came out of his pants, man. I mean, I couldn't get away from it fast enough. And it lands dead center on the deck. We have video crew on the thing. All cameras go to the fish. It's on all the screens. I mean, it was just an absolutely fantastic moment. Absolutely fantastic moment. He didn't get the guitar the whole night. He got something different
the song?
Every time. No, oh, they played the song. Yeah, somebody else started the song and they played it. Hmm. Yeah. Like I say, last night of the tour, all bets are off, man. things are going to happen.
When the fish comes out.
I did a last night of the tour thing with Maiden where Nico, the drummer, was on a children's show called Sooty back when he was a little kid. And it's a bear. It's a thing in the UK. But the production manager went and rented a Sooty suit and had me climb into the lighting rig in this bear costume. And I had to wait till the middle of a drum solo. And I rappelled down in front of Nico during this drum solo in this bear outfit.
As Sooty,
the bear. That's so good. Nico thought it was the funniest thing ever. And of course, Bruce felt upstage, so he literally chased me around the stage. You know, I'm running around in this bear outfit with this giant bear head on me, and he finally caught me and tore the head off, and was like, "Oh, it's the septic."
Yeah.
And I walked off.
Oh, so good.
Yeah. That's a good one. That's a cool one. Well, gentlemen, I do appreciate your time. If you do have any more, you can continue to share them. But if not, thank you for the ones you shared.
We could be here for hours, honestly, after 40 plus years of this crap.
Yeah.
Well, cool. We'll talk soon.
Thank you, man. Thanks for the invite.
Thanks for watching. Don't forget to like and subscribe by clicking the round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or the guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle's Joel Rody. And don't forget, when you party like a rock star, don't be a dick.